You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 115, Ezekiel chapter 6. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. How are you, Trey?
I'm doing pretty good.
Staying busy.
How was your trip last week?
Oh, it was good. We had probably pushing 50 people at the event. Then we had a nice, you know, get together afterwards. It was in Potomac Falls, Cascades Library there in Virginia, near D.C. So, yeah, I mean, people seem to appreciate the content, appreciate, you know, coming out. Good questions. It was a pretty good group.
Yeah, well, good deal. Well, I'm excited about continuing with Ezekiel, so we might as well just get right to it.
Yeah, well, I hope you and everybody else really are into idolatry, at least hearing about it.
Right,
at least that's pretty much all we're going to get. Yeah, at least reading it. So, yeah, Ezekiel 6 is pretty much just about the, you know, why Jerusalem is being punished, you know, for idolatry. So, obviously, it comes on the heels of Ezekiel 4 and 5 with that whole series of sign acts against the city of Jerusalem. And so in chapter 6, we basically get the reason why God is so upset. And it's just all about idolatry. Remember, really, chapters 1 through 24 are oracles of judgment against Judah and Jerusalem. This is, of course, falling into the midst of that. But this one really kind of stilts toward, you know, why is God so upset? We're going to find out, you know, in this chapter. And, you know, it's really not going to pull any punches. So the main focus is going to be, for the whole episode, Israelite idolatry. And really, it's the main focus of the cause of the exile, not just in Ezekiel, although especially in Ezekiel, but, you know, in other prophets as well. I'm going to read the whole chapter. It's only 14 verses. And then we're going to take a look at some vocabulary, again, that just really focuses on idolatry. We're going to talk about kind of the state of the spiritual apostasy in Judah, but, you know, it'll be wider than that as well when we talk about Israel's idolatry, just the history of it anyway. So let's jump in here with chapter 6 and verse 1, and I'm reading from the ESV. The word of the Lord came to me, "Son of man, set your face toward the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them and say, 'You mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord God. Thus says the Lord God to the mountains and the hills, to the ravines and the valleys, behold, I, even I, will bring a sword upon you, and I will destroy your high places. Your altars shall become desolate, and your incense altars shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain before your idols, and I will lay the dead bodies of the people of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones around your altars. Wherever you dwell, the cities shall be waste and the high places ruined, so that your altars will be waste and ruined, your idols broken and destroyed, your incense altars cut down, and your works wiped out. And the slain shall fall in your midst, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Yet I will leave some of you alive. When you have among the nations some who escape the sword, and when you are scattered through the countries, then those of you who escape will remember me among the nations where they are carried captive, how I have been broken over their whoring heart that has departed from me, and over their eyes that go whoring after their idols. And they will be loathsome in their own sight for the evils that they have committed, for all their abominations. And they shall know that I am the Lord. I have not said in vain that I would do this evil to them. Thus says the Lord God, clap your hands and stamp your foot and say, alas, because of all the evil abominations of the house of Israel, for they shall fall by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. He who is far off shall die of pestilence, and he who is near shall fall by the sword. And he who is left and is preserved shall die of famine. Thus I will spend my fury upon them. And you shall know that I am the Lord when their slain lie among their idols around their altars on every high hill, on all the mountaintops, under every green tree and under every leafy oak, wherever they offered pleasing aroma to all their idols. And I will stretch out my hand against them and make the land desolate and waste in all their dwelling places from the wilderness to Riblah. Then they will know that I am the Lord." So that's the whole chapter. There are some things in here that I'm going to reserve comment for later chapters. For instance, the sexual imagery of idolatry. I have been broken over their whoring heart. You know, that kind of language. We'll really hit that in force when we get to Ezekiel 16, which is extremely explicit. I mean, if we really translated literally what's there, you might be tempted to call it, you know, pornographic when we get there. But we'll save that content for that chapter, since that's sort of a focus there. You know, obviously you get references to, you know, the remnant idea. We'll say a little bit about that. Sword, famine, and pestilence. Again, we talked about this a little bit, how, you know, there's sort of an immediate destruction and the aftermath. People are still going to die. You know, Ezekiel has already indicated that the devastation is going to be thorough. I mean, we talked in chapters 4 and 5 about how the language is so thorough. Can we really be sure that there's going to be anybody left? And then, you know, Ezekiel parted, you know, took his hair and put it into three parts, and then all of them were destroyed, but yet he pulled a few out and kept them in his garment, that sort of thing. You get the same idea here. I mean, where it says even those who escape, you know, they're going to die, you know. Well, it's not going to be everybody totally. It's not a totality, because he says a few verses earlier that some will remain. So we want to talk a little bit again about the remnant idea, develop that a little bit in this chapter, but you're going to see that in ensuing chapters as well. But primarily, we're going to spend our time today in this chapter on the whole issue of idolatry. Now, if you listened to the Leviticus series, there would be some content here in what I just read that would be familiar. A lot of the designations that we just read, the designations for pagan idolatrous, pagan cultic objects and places, that vocabulary is actually also found in Leviticus 26, specifically verses 14 through 33. And that, again, recall, was about if the nation apostatizes, what's going to happen to them. There was this series of this cursing language in Leviticus. And specifically in Leviticus 26, the notion of faithfulness to God, you know, only having Him as your God and being a people sanctified to Him, that was tied, you know, to the greatest commandment, that you will worship no other God. Again, this believing loyalty idea we talked about in Leviticus 26. And that, in turn, was tied to your presence in the land. And we've talked before about how the Abrahamic covenant, the land elements, were not totally unconditional. I mean, Leviticus 26, the curses in Deuteronomy, you know, 28, 29. I mean, it's very, 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 very obvious that being in the land had something to do with refusing to worship other gods. I mean, it's just point blank. So the Abrahamic covenant does have conditional elements. They're very clear, even going back into Genesis 12, Genesis 15, the original covenants. You know, God told Abraham, Genesis 17, walk before me and be blameless. Genesis 22, the whole issue, the offering of Isaac, you know, God says, well, now I'm going to honor my covenant because you have not withheld to me your only son. I mean, there are conditions on all the covenants. So anyone who tells you that the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, these fundamental covenants in biblical theology are unconditional, they're not. They're actually both. They're both unconditional and conditional. They all have conditions, every one of them. But there's also this unconditional idea. And what I mean by that, again, to recap, you know, sort of content we've gone through in Leviticus, was God made these covenants with the full intention that no matter what happens, I am going to get my way. I am going to have a people, you know, raised up from Abraham and Sarah. I am going to bring them into a land. I am going to have a family. You know, in other words, there's divine intent that never goes away. As bad as it gets, God never gives up on, you know, his covenantal promises. But whether an Israelite, whether a descendant of Abraham and Sarah, or anyone for that matter, gets the participatory benefit of the covenant, that had conditions all the way around. So you actually have both working. A lot of people want to say that these covenants are totally unconditional because they want the land element to be still out there. And that's because they have a certain view of the end times and eschatology and the kingdom and the millennium and all that stuff. Okay, you don't need to be blind to the conditions of the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant to get those things. It's just that people, again, try to argue their point, argue their perspective from, you know, a certain way, and it's really not faithful to the text, you know, certain things that are said. So we have a situation here where Israel, this whole chapter, Ezekiel 6, is kind of a concise statement of how the people of Judah, remember, again, the people of Israel, the northern kingdom, are already history at this point. And we've talked about the all Israel language and the family of Israel, the house of Israel language, really, again, referring to descendants from Jacob, descendants from Israel, the person, at this point in Israel's history. So you have a concise statement here of how these people violated this principle, worship no other god before me, believing loyalty to Yahweh alone. And it led to their expulsion from the land. That's where they are. They're in exile. So that's what the whole chapter is about. Now, I want to focus on some of the specific terminology, and I'm going to be reading from a number of sources here, some articles on vocabulary, and again, idolatry in general, and I'll give you a heads up and telegraph, you know, what those sources are. But there are a number of terms used in Ezekiel 6 that you will also find in Leviticus 26. I'll just give you the quick list here. Bamot, okay, high places. That's in Ezekiel 6, verse 3. Verse 6, you'll find it in Leviticus 26, 30. The singular is Bama. Bama, a high place, just in most general terms, was not necessarily a cult center built on a mountain or built at an elevated location, although a lot of them were. But the designation as of high place also referred to sort of their style. There were these cult centers, these ritual places of ritual that had elevated stands and platforms, you know, with steps going up, that sort of thing. So the term also refers to that style of architecture, cultic installations, again, that were, you know, in many cases, as we'll see, you know, dedicated to other deities, other gods. So Bamot is an important term, high places. We have Kamanim, typically translated incense altars. We're going to be getting into that terminology a little bit about what else it might mean. So these would have been associated with the high places, with these ritual locations. And, you know, Kamanim, the incense altars, are in verses 4 and 6. You'll find those in Leviticus 26:30 as well. We've got Gilulim, usually translated idols, verses 4, 6, and 13 in Ezekiel 6. Also, Leviticus 26:30, and right out of that passage, Gilulim, idols. We have Pegarim, which the ESV translates as, you know, corpses or dead bodies, verse 5, for instance. Also, Leviticus 26:30. We'll talk about what else that might mean. So those are the main terms I want to cover here. There's one or two others, but I'm going to skip those sort of for time and focus on the main issues, the main you know, the main lemmas here, the main terms, and talk about them. So let's go back to Bamot, high places, and just talk about this series of objects, this series of terms, so we can begin to get a picture of what the state of apostasy, spiritual apostasy, was in Israel, and specifically in the context of Ezekiel, we're talking about Judah and Jerusalem. So I'm reading from I'll read a section here from the Dictionary of the Old Testament Historical Books. This is part of the InterVarsity series, and I recommend the whole series, by the way, these dictionaries. I've contributed to a couple of them myself, some Divine Council articles and a few other things. But on the entry on idolatry, there's a discussion of Bamot, and it says this, Bamot, it means high places. These are cultic installations found in a variety of locations in Israel, and used by the population before and during the monarchy. So again, before we have kings and during the time that there are kings. Continuing, Bama is a generic term related to places where sacrifices were offered. Prior to the monarchy, Bamot, again that's the plural, were considered legitimate worship spaces and receive no condemnation, neither for their existence nor for their use. Bamote met the religious needs of the fluid environment of the tribal confederacy, of the 12 tribes, along with the, quote, temple or house of Yahweh at Shiloh, which was a semi-permanent structure, perhaps built around the ancient tabernacle. Now, let me stop there. What the situation was, I mean, think about it. We have the conquest. They go into the land. You know, if you've read the Book of Judges, you know that, you know, the Book of Judges makes a point to say, well, none of the tribes really did the job completely in terms of, yeah, you know, they targeted the Anakim. Joshua says there's no more Anakim in the land, but they flee to where the Philistines live. We get that part. But the other part of the conquest was the expulsion, not necessarily the killing, but the expulsion of peoples from the lands, and of course, avoiding their gods, avoiding intermarriage, you know, avoiding living like they do, these sorts of situations. And the Book of Judges makes it very clear, first couple chapters, that the Israelites just didn't do that. They didn't do the job. And so in the midst of this failure, we go into the period of the Judges with all these cycles of oppression. God doesn't help them, you know, to complete the task, and they get invaded by foreigners or overtaken by indigenous inhabitants. And you go through these cycles of oppression, and God raises up a judge, and then they get delivered. Then the whole thing repeats again, all that. Again, if you've read the Book of Judges, that's very familiar to you. So when they go into the land, they're in the land during the period of the Judges, but they don't have a central place of worship. It's everyone doing what is right in his own eyes, you know, to quote the Book of Judges in several places. There's no temple. We find out when we emerge from the Book of Judges, remember Samuel was the last of the judges, that we have, you know, some sort of religious site at Shiloh, again, as the quotation noted, perhaps built around the ancient tabernacle, because Eli the priest is there, again, the Ark of the Covenant's there. You know, are all the furnishings of the tabernacle there? Well, the Old Testament isn't totally clear on that. You know, we get later into the monarchy, and there are parts of the tabernacle in some places and not in others. And you don't have a centralized place of worship as God intended. Again, to have a specific, to quote Deuteronomy, a specific place where God would set his name, put his name. If you've read Unseen Realm, you're familiar with the name theology. These are references to a central location where the tabernacle, again, would essentially be transported, and that's where it lives now. And then we build a temple, and we install the ark and all that kind of stuff. Now, that eventually happens under Solomon, but you have a long period of time where you don't have a central site. So what you have instead is just what the quotation described. You have high places, bamot, in different locations around the land, sort of like what you have with the patriarchs. Remember, the patriarchs would build altars where they had divine encounters and they would worship Yahweh there. There was no central location. You have sort of that kind of thing going on. And what the author here is trying to describe here is, prior to the monarchy, you have this situation where you have a number of high places, and Yahweh might be worshipped at one of those, or some other god might be worshipped at another one. But you don't have a condemnation of the high places in particular in that situation because of, frankly, just what it is. I mean, it is what it is. The people, again, are not, you know, spiritually with it. They're under the oppression. God raises up judges. Eventually, the prophets, and, you know, God's going to use people like Samuel to get things turned around, get a monarchy, you know, installed. And again, if you're thinking God was opposed to kingship all along, that is also not correct. There are rules in Deuteronomy about kings. So there was an intention. You know, the kingship wasn't necessarily bad. What's bad is the reasons they asked for it, what their motives are, all that sort of thing. As the kind of person they target. Again, we don't want to lapse here into a discussion of 1 Samuel here, but this was what was supposed to happen. Well, eventually it does. Eventually we get David installed, but he's not allowed to build a temple because he's a man of blood, and we know the story. You know, it falls to Solomon. Again, his whole point is that prior to when we actually get a temple, a central place of worship, Yahweh is still worshipped by faithful Israelites in the land, and they do it in a variety of places, and those places are called Bamot, high places, the places of ritual, places of where worship occurs, where sacrifices are performed. And there are a variety of these. So let's go back to the quote, or the source here, the dictionary. The author continues, even though a plurality of Bamot existed, there's no hint in the narrative that the people were sacrificing indiscriminately. Again, you have the worship of Yahweh going on. Back to the source. During the monarchy, however, Bamot were considered illegitimate. Again, during the monarchy, they were considered illegitimate worship places and received considerable condemnation for their existence and use. After the building of Solomon's temple, their inadequacy should have been apparent. Yet people continued to sacrifice at and multiply Bamot as if no temple existed. The text mentions four categories of Bamot. Number one, Yahweh's Bamot, in his high places. Two, foreign deity Bamot. Three, high places of the gates, again, whatever that means. And four, houses of the high places. All these construction projects receive condemnation. The situation resulted in a heightened expectation for the kings to remove Bamot, particularly in the Judean kingdom. Why particularly in Judea or Judah? Well, because that's where Jerusalem was. That's where the temple is. Again, source. Although Hezekiah removed Yahweh's Bamot, you know, and that was legitimate for Hezekiah to do because now we have a temple. Once the temple is erected, this is me talking now, once the temple is erected, the other Bamot, even if Yahweh was worshipped there, don't make any sense. So, you know, after that we have the temple, the prophets are running around telling the kings to tear them all down, get rid of them, because now we have a temple. So back to the source here. Although Hezekiah removed Yahweh's Bamot, it was Josiah who finally destroyed all foreign deity Bamot, including those built by Solomon and Jeroboam's northern houses of the high places, the Beit Bamot, with its associated personnel. So it's only under, this is me now, it's only under Josiah where the situation basically gets cleaned up. Now, it's not going to stay that way. And we know that if we've read the books of Kings. But Josiah is the one who does the most to correct the situation. Now, this reference to Solomon's Bamot, I think, deserves a little bit of a sidebar here. Examples of Solomon building high places in addition to or in opposition to the temple to Yahweh that he builds. I mean, Solomon actually builds Bamot along with, you know, the temple, and he builds them in Jerusalem in proximity to the temple. An example would be 1 Kings 11:7. It says, "Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem." Pretty clear. 2 Kings 23:13, another example, a little bit repetitive, but there's some other details here. "And the king defiled the high places that were east of Jerusalem, to the south of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon the king of Israel had built for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Sidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites." So, I mean, Solomon builds high places for rival deities. The, you know, this whole situation, especially with Molech and Chemosh, and I think in particular, as 1 Kings 11:7 said, that they're located east of Jerusalem. I mean, that, here you have two of the worst foreign deities, and their high places, their Bamot, are erected right, again, in proximity to Jerusalem. So this little geographical sideline here that we get in this verse, or actually both these verses, you have, again, sort of a signal to Solomon kind of accommodating competitors, divine competitors with Yahweh, right there in Jerusalem. I mean, this is Solomon. So it really, you know, it really, you know, again, the apostasy, what we think of as the apostasy of Israel, the apostasy, and Solomon, of course, is reigning over all the tribes. It's not just the north. It's not just the northern kingdom. It's not just after Solomon's time, after the kingdom splits. I mean, Solomon is part, a significant part of the problem. Let's go back to the dictionary, read a little bit more. For the building of Solomon's temple, we do not know who the originators of these other Bamot, these other installations were. The text simply mentioned the presence of Bamot. The term is associated with the introduction of Saul to Samuel. There's a reference to a Bamot in that story. And Saul's encounter with a band of prophets. That's 1 Samuel 9, 1 Samuel 10. 1 Kings 3, verses 3 and 4, announces Solomon's preference for the Gibeon, Bama, the high place at Gibeon. And 1 Kings 3, 2 notes that Bamot were used by the general population. These passages presuppose the existence of Bamot without stating their origin, or who built them. The narratives of the northern kingdom focus on structures that originated with Jeroboam. Besides the sanctuaries at Dan and Bethel, Jeroboam constructed numerous, quote, Beit Bamot, houses of the high places, 1 Kings 12, for instance. The fact that Jeroboam built Beit Bamot, houses of the high places, and not merely Bamot, not merely house or high places, distinguishes northern from southern Bamot. In other words, the northern ones had some sort of bigger complex associated with it. As was the case under Rehoboam of Judah, the people followed in Jeroboam's footsteps and built Bamot for themselves. This in contrast to the pre-monarchical period. The text clearly communicates that Bamot originated with certain kings and people. And now two categories of Bamot existed. And once you get into the monarchy, there were foreign deity Bamot and, of course, Yahweh's Bamot that had existed prior to, you know, the monarchy. So we have two kinds, you know, of Bamot. But again, once the temple is built, all of them should have just been superfluous. And especially if they're, if foreign deities are being worshipped, they're abominable. Back to the source here. Even with Solomon's temple at center stage, sacrificing at Yahweh's Bamot continued. We get an indication of that in 1 Kings 3, 2. I'll read that to you. The people were sacrificing at the high places. However, because no house had yet been built for the name of the Lord, if you go over to 2 Chronicles 33, we have here a reference to the altar of the Lord and temple, but it says in verse 17, nevertheless, the people still sacrificed at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. So you still had people worshiping Yahweh at other sites besides the temple, even after we had the temple. Again, the source continues, in fact, each Judean king, starting with Asa through Jotham, was suspect because he did not remove or tear down the Bamot. And once we have the temple, what are we doing with these other ones, these other high places? By association, they probably continued using them for sacrificial purposes. The text's emphasis on the kings and their inability to remove Bamot reflects the expectations articulated in 1 Kings 3, 2. Bamot should have been discarded, presumably because they were obsolete and replaced by the Jerusalem temple. However, it was not until the arrival of Hezekiah that these hopes were met, at least in part, and then, of course, Josiah later on. Now, let's transition here to another term, kamanim, the incense altars. Again, these would have been part of a Bamot place, a high place, you know, place of worship. So the high places where sacrifices are going to be offered. Again, before the monarchy, you had a bunch of them. Yahweh was worshipped and other deities were worshipped. And even after we have the temple, most of the kings just left them alone. And people were using them, even though there was a temple. And that's what the prophets were angry about. Both, quote, legitimate Bamot that had been used for Yahweh, they should go by the wayside. They're obsolete. And of course, there should be no Bamot to foreign deities. In those complexes, you'd have incense altars. Again, that was part of the ritual worship. Remember our series on Leviticus? There was incense used as part of the various sacrificial rituals. So Ezekiel chapter 6 mentions these as well. Now, Block, in his commentary on Ezekiel, has this to say about the kamanim, again, the quote-unquote incense altars. He says, the word kamanim is usually thought to derive from a verb kamam, to be hot. and interpreted either as incense altars or some object associated with the sun cult. Again, the sun is hot. Represented by the deity Baal Hamon, a deity referred to in a 9th century Phoenician text from Zingiro, and later worshipped as the patron deity of Carthage. However, Block says, both this etymology and this interpretation now seem doubtful. Evidence from Ugarit suggests that the word Hamam, to be hot, and the name of the deity, Hamon, derive from different roots. The confusion arises from the requirement in Hebrew that the letter Chet, if you know a little Hebrew here, you'll be able to follow this, but the confusion that the requirement in Hebrew that the letter Chet represented two distinct Semitic letters. Okay, in other Semitic languages, I'll just stop here. If you know Hebrew, you have two H's, He and Chet. You know, the Chet is, again, a little harder in pronunciation. Well, in other Semitic languages, what is Chet in Hebrew actually splits into two separate consonants. They're two hard H's. So you'd have a total of three H's in other Semitic languages. So what Block is saying is that this association with Chamon, that the deity, is actually probably not correct because it would have been spelled with one of these other letters. So it's not the same term, even though it sounds to our ear like it's the same. So he says here, although the root Chamam, to be hot, does occur in Ugaritic, the name of the deity Chamon is written with, again, this H with a little curvy line under it, this third H, which opens the possibility of a link with another Semitic word, another Semitic root, Kama, to protect. So maybe Kamanim comes from this idea of this verb to protect. He's saying, like, you know, who knows? It just could be a number of different things. These don't have to be incense altars for this deity Baal Hamon, is Block's point. This picture, where we might have a, again, some building based off of this idea of a lemma that means to protect or to enclose, might be another way to translate it. Block says, it might denote that the Kamanim denoted a sanctuary or some sort of chapel that was part of a Bamot complex. And he says, this picture of the Kamana or the Hamanim accords with every occurrence of Haman in the Old Testament, and is particularly helpful in elucidating 2 Chronicles 34:4, which speaks of tearing down the altars of Baal and the Kamanim that were high above them. It is difficult to visualize incense altars meeting that description. And you have an altar and then some this Kamanim thing that is above them. Block says, if the Kamanim were understood as a cultic building, some kind of chapel, then the statement in 2 Chronicles 34:4 makes sense. In other words, the altars of Baal get torn down and the little chapels that they're in. So Kamanim is probably, again, some sort of reference, not really to an incense altar, even though the ESV has it translated that way and other English translations will. But it's probably some sort of little chapel that's part of a Bamot complex, a high place, a place of worship, some little chapel there. Another term, Gilulim, the idols. There are actually a number of terms for idols in the Hebrew Bible. This is not sort of the normal one that you'd read about in the Torah, for instance. You'd have something like Pesel, which is a graven image. This is a totally different term, and the etymology for it is actually controversial. It's not clear where this term comes from. Ezekiel uses this term, though, a lot. It occurs 48 times in the Old Testament. 39 of those are in Ezekiel. So it's a special word that Ezekiel uses in particular in describing something, describing, you know, false worship of something. Now, DDD, the Dictionary of Deities and Demons, has an entry on the Gilulim, and I want to give you a little excerpt from that. It says that many scholars derive Gilulim from a hypothetical noun, galol, which would mean stela, sort of an upright stone object, whose vocalization has been deliberately modified by the Israelite prophets to correspond to the vowel pattern of the word shikutsim, abominations. Now, what that means, this is me talking now, if you have three consonants, galal, G-L-L, what this article is suggesting, or this entry, this viewpoint is probably better to say, is suggesting is that, well, maybe this term comes from a word that has the consonants GLL, and to make it an abhorrent term, the Hebrews and the scribes, and even verbally, would take the vowels of the word for abominations, shikutsim. You have an I and an U vowel sound. And they would insert those vowels between GLL, and that's where you get gilulim. So it's kind of an artificial word, but it would refer to some sort of object that people were to view as an abhorrence, as something detestable. Again, that's the guess for where this comes from, because there's no clear noun, ulema, root word gilul, anywhere in biblical Hebrew or other Semitic languages. And so the guess is that the biblical writers took this GLL term, galul, this other lemma, and stuck these vowels in again to make it an object of abhorrence. And biblical writers do that with other, they do that with proper names, like Mephibosheth. That's not the actual original name of that person in the Hebrew Bible in Israelite history. It's that the second part of the name was given, was substituted with the term Boshet. So Mephibosheth. Boshet means shame, or to be ashamed, or something like that. So, you know, Ish-Boshet. There are instances where a person's name would have this word appended to it to sort of mark them as something shameful. And so the speculation here is that, well, maybe they're doing the same thing with this particular upright stone or cult object. So again, DDD, to go back there, goes on and says, you essentially have two possibilities here. You have an originally neutral term for stela, upright object, that becomes a dysphemism or a pejorative term that signifies deities other than the Lord, okay, that are basically abominable. They're garbage. They're shameful. Second possibility, again, is that, you know, there are some scholars that would say, well, that's possible. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, maybe they were doing that. But they also note, and this is going to be especially true with like later rabbinic sources will make this argument, that you do have a GLL term in Hebrew that has nothing to do with an idol or an object, but it means poop. Okay, it means feces. For instance, Ezekiel 4:12 uses this term, Ezekiel 22:3. And so the other view is that, well, maybe Ezekiel is taking a term for feces, which would normally be pronounced gelalim, and again takes that and alters it to gilulim, maybe again taking the vowels from the word for abominations, the shikutsim, the things that are detestable, in Leviticus. And so maybe he just basically does double duty. He takes this word, which means something bad, something unclean and stinky, okay, feces, and then it changes it with the vowels to make it refer to an object, again, a cultic object that should be viewed as abhorrent and detestable. The short answer is nobody really knows. Both of those options are kind of workable. A lot of people like the reference to feces there as the explanation, because Ezekiel, to try to not be explicit or blunt here, we're going to see elsewhere that Ezekiel is very fond of graphic language. And when it comes to chapter 16, it's going to be very sexual in nature. We've already, again, seen references to, you know, human dung, you know, that God said, I'm going to make you cook over this. And Ezekiel says, no way, I'm a priest. I can't touch this unclean stuff. Well, there are going to be other places where Ezekiel will use very earthy, very graphic language. And so scholars would say, you know, this would be like Ezekiel. This would be something he'd do. He'd take a word for feces and he'd put new vowels in it to make it refer to, you know, some sort of, you know, erectable object rather than just something that you expel, you know, as a normal human being. He would do this, again, because it's colorful, because it's graphic, because it's memorable. it would be something that would leave no doubt as to how Ezekiel feels about what he's talking about. Okay. Now, I'll add a little bit more to this. Ezekiel again uses Gilulim, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, more than any other prophet. Other prophets use sort of normal words for idols, and 39 out of 48 times Ezekiel opts for this term we're talking about, Gilulim. He's also the only author that uses the verb defile in relation to Gilulim. It's in chapter 18, chapter 20, a few times, chapter 30, so on and so forth. So this is in part also, again, scholars figure that since he's specifically using verbiage that you'll find in Leviticus, and again, he's a priest, he's specifically using verbiage that is associated with things that are defiling. And many of those things in Leviticus that are defiling have to do with bodily fluids, bodily functions, or again, other things that are determined to be unclean. You know, you would make a person ritually unclean. That again, it becomes part of the argument that, yeah, Ezekiel would probably be the guy who would do this, who would play with the language in this way. And so a lot of people sort of opt, you know, for this second possibility, that what we're talking about is a play on words that denotes an object, but because of what's done with it, makes you think of that object as crap. Okay. I mean, you know, to put it that way, as clean as I can put it here. And again, since Ezekiel is very fond of this kind of language, I think it's probably a good bet, you know, that that's what's going on. But the truth is that nobody quite knows for sure where the term comes from. One more here, Pegarim, which the ESV has as corpses, dead bodies. Again, also found in Leviticus 26:30. And I might as well read that verse. You know, I've brought up the verse a number of times here. So we're at the last of our vocabulary words here. And they all show up in Leviticus 26:30, which says, I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and cast your dead bodies upon the dead bodies of your idols, and my soul will abhor you. Again, this is in response to, if you don't worship only me, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to drive you out of the land, and this is going to be the result. So all of that vocabulary finds its way here in Ezekiel. So back to Pegarim, there is a word in Hebrew, peger, which denotes human bodies or corpses. Okay, in many places, not every reference. There's a homograph issue here. There is another peger, but typically the one that you find in the Hebrew Bible is related to, again, a dead body. The verb means to grow faint, you know, to become weak, you know, like sort of like a, you know, metaphorically, you could see where that would be related to the act of dying, that sort of thing. The verb is going to be used in context where someone is dying or right at the time of death or something like that. So the noun, again, is very, very well known, very common. Now, some have suggested, though, that we have not peger in terms of a corpse, but peger in terms of a different word that occurs in other Semitic languages in certain texts, where it's probably also, again, an upright object, maybe a heap of stones or a stela as well. And without getting into the external textual data, there's one a particular text that has the word SKN, Sakan, which everybody knows means stela or heap of stones, in parallel to PGR, peger. And so some people think, well, that makes more sense here, because let's go back to Leviticus 26:30. Here's what I just read to you. See if you detect sort of an odd phrase here. I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and cast your dead bodies upon the dead bodies of your idols, and my soul will abhor you. Well, that just sounds kind of odd. I will cast your dead bodies upon the dead bodies of your idols. What's weird about the verse is that pegarim occurs twice in the verse. And so that's why ESV translates it, I will cast your dead bodies upon the dead bodies of your idols. Well, a lot of scholars say, well, the second of these shouldn't be dead bodies. It should be this other PGR word. And if that's the case, here's how you would translate it. I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and cast your dead bodies at or upon the stelae of your idols. In other words, these cultic objects that represent your idols, and my soul will abhor you. There's another place in Ezekiel in chapter 43 where this sort of makes sense. And so, yeah, you know, it probably does refer not to corpses here. It probably refers to some, again, cultic object, you know, some sort of stone, standing stone, whatever. So if we take all four of these terms, you've got Bamot, you've got Kamanim, which is, again, probably a little chapel. Bamot is just sort of the whole complex, the whole ritual location, the altar, as it were, you know, where sacrifices are offered. And then there's a chapel associated with that. And then you've got the Gilulim, again, probably an object that gets its name to mark it as something detestable, or so that when people look at it and think about it, they're just grossed out by it. You know, again, it becomes something abhorrent. And then this Pegarim, again, referring again to some sort of upright cult object. This is what Ezekiel's targeting in this whole chapter. God says, I'm going to destroy all of these things because they're all present in my land, and my people are worshiping other gods with these things. And some of them are probably thinking they're worshiping him through these cultic objects and these high places. And again, this is at the root of their apostasy. Again, not essentially not just cleaning house. I mean, not getting rid of all this stuff. Now, I want to talk a little bit more, even more generally, about idolatry. There's an interesting article, I can't, unfortunately, make it something accessible. I couldn't find it online. I had to get it through a database. But Milgram has an article, The Nature and Extent of Idolatry in 8th and 7th Century BC Judah. Again, this is the monarchic period, you know, leading up into, you know, the point of exile here. And it just has some interesting stuff in it. I want to read you a few excerpts from it. He says here that the datable biblical literature of the 8th century accuses Israel of idolatry 15 times. The literature of the following 7th century does it 166 times, which is really an imbalance, right? So Milgram says, in the 7th century, the prophets repeatedly stated that idolatry, quote, pollutes its inheritance, the temple, and the land. It just all over the place, they use this pollute terminology. The quantitative difference in the number of statements on idolatry between the 8th and 7th centuries is accentuated by the difference in the effects of idolatry, as illustrated by the use of this term, you know, tame, to be unclean. It most, you know, all of that kind of language occurs in texts that are datable to the 7th century. Now, think about it. 7th century is the 600 BC, 600s BC. 8th century is the 700s BC. Well, most of the attention in the 8th century BC, again, this is Mike talking now, most of the attention in 8th century BC texts is going to be the northern, you know, apostate kingdom. And you get, okay, 15 times, you know, complaining about the idolatry and whatnot. It's exponentially more after the northern kingdom is gone. And you say, well, why would that be? Well, I think it's kind of obvious because now you're talking about Judah and you're talking about the place where Yahweh's own house is. You're talking about the place of the Davidic dynasty, the Davidic covenant, whole thing, you know, the temple. And so the prophets basically just lose their minds that this kind of thing has now moved south into Judah and it's just exploding. Okay, and so they just go kind of berserk, you know, with this whole situation. And the texts reflect this dramatically more vociferous concern or objection in the 7th century because of the proximity to the presence of Yahweh in Jerusalem. So it just gets blown up into a much bigger deal. So Milgram says, again, it's sort of in a summary statement. How can we account for this stupendous change? First, as we mentioned above, we must take the Book of Kings at its word. Jehu in North Israel and Jehoiada in Judah wiped out the Baal cult during the second half of the 9th century. In effect, that means that state-sponsored paganism was basically eradicated. It is absent through the 8th century, so there's not as much of it, and where it is, it's going to be in the north. To be sure, there was private fetishism, he uses that term, private idolatry. But the 8th century prophets were virtually unconcerned about, again, this sort of private people going off and doing crazy stuff in their house. It was no threat to the worship of Yahweh in his sanctuary or to Israel's existence on its land, because then the issue was, you know, the temple. Now, he says here, to be sure, Molech worship and necromancy are indeed indicated in the text, but the general populace didn't view these acts as, you know, incompatible with their allegiance to Yahweh, a misconception that, you know, the prophets are going to try to correct. But his point is that the big issue for the prophets, and the thing he's arguing that really gets tied to the land, is when you start using rival cult centers and building rival cult centers in Jerusalem, okay, in proximity to Yahweh's presence in the temple, that was essentially the straw that broke the camel's back. That is sort of the trigger point to God saying, enough. I'm going, you know, the northern kingdom, you know, got what it deserved because of idolatry. You know, the Davidic dynasty is still intact. This is a legitimate dynasty. This is where I live. This is my temple. This is my sanctuary. This is sacred ground, but it doesn't matter. Okay. If you're going to invade my sacred space with this kind of stuff, you're all toast. I'm not going to spare the monarchy. I'm not going to spare the priesthood. My hands are not tied. You know, God is basically saying, my hands are not tied here just because the temple's here, just because this is where my presence is. I'm going to drive you from the land. And so the prophetic criticism, the call, you know, against apostasy doesn't go away or doesn't get any softer because, oh, now we're talking about Jerusalem and David's line. God says, who gives a rip? I don't care what we're talking about here. In fact, this is exactly the sort of thing that I warned you back in Leviticus 26, back in the Torah, that I would do if you violated this. So don't think there's any security in the fact that, hey, we're still alive and we didn't get, you know, killed off with the 10 tribes in the north. And they're the ones that split, you know, they're the ones that split up the kingdom. Those are the bad guys. You know, we're here in Judah. We're, you know, we're loyal to David. We only have Davidic kings down here and we have the temple. We're not, you know, building other temples, you know, all these high places. Yeah. Yeah. We still use those. And yeah, you know, Solomon built a couple of those and we didn't tear them down, but we still have the temple here and this is God's place. And God's not going to touch this. He's not going to destroy this because this is his temple. God says, phooey. I don't care. I don't care about any of the things you think keep you safe with respect to your relationship with me. What I care about is where is your loyalty? You know, you're not going to dress yourself up with these other things. While on the other hand, you're doing exactly the same things I said would mean expulsion from the land. It's just not going to protect you. So I think it's really, again, just sort of an interesting perspective. I mean, Milgram goes on in the article. He does a lot of other interesting things. He talks about how with the prophets, the big deal, again, was state-sponsored paganism. In other words, you don't just build a high place. You don't build Bamot next to the temple, you know, in Jerusalem or in Judah or in proximity to the holy city. You don't just do that. That takes royal approval. That takes state sponsorship. Okay. Those things don't get built unless the people in charge, who are the kings and even peripherally the priests, those things don't happen unless those people either approve them or don't try to stop them. And so, again, that's the real issue. You don't have any account in the Old Testament of prophets or priests or kings or anybody going house to house checking to see if they have Asherah figures, you know, their little idols or teraphim or anything like that. So there's no indication that, anybody called for or sort of tried to eradicate idolatry at a house-to-house level. What's typically the focus is this state-sponsored paganism. Because, again, this is David's line. David, the man after God's own heart. You know, the line that God promised, you know, was the only legitimate one that would sit on the throne. And the temple, the only place that God said, I will put my name there, I will dwell there. That is by far, that is the far greater focus of apostasy and idolatry. You know, and frankly, if the priests aren't doing their job, people are just going to do what they're going to do. And this makes me think of like situations now. And, you know, I'm not going to name any names. I'm not going to, you know, give too pointed an illustration here. But we all know Christians and churches who do stuff that we kind of hear or we see and we think, good grief, if the Lord was here, he'd just have a canary. I mean, he would just go berserk. He would say, this is nuts. You know, this is just not legitimate. This is not real worship. This is abominable. This is wrong. It's bad. It's misguided. Whatever. Okay. We all know that. And so that's kind of the lens through which I look at stuff like this. That, yeah, people and nobody has Bibles. Okay. They're all dependent on the priests. They're all dependent on, you know, if mom and dad learn anything from the priest, they're supposed to transmit it to the kids. I mean, nobody can just go look up, hey, should we do this or not? Should we do this or that? Is it okay to use this cult center now, even though we have a temple? It's kind of a shorter trip. And Yahweh was worshipped there by our ancestors. Is that okay? Well, if you don't have prophets or priests or whoever teaching the people, they're just going to go astray. And it's not that God is thrilled with that or God approves of it. He doesn't, because you know that's part of the critique here. But what he's far more concerned with is the institutional faith, is institutional Israelite religion, state-sponsored paganism. Do with that what you want. But, I mean, I look at the church on an institutional level. And, again, we can all think of just bizarro world examples where ministries – and churches have just literally jumped the shark. I mean, they are apostate. And because they're big, because they're public, again, because they have lots of people under their charge or under their care, and multitudes are led astray. What the situation was here back in Judah is that is a much bigger problem. That is a much bigger concern because it's institutionalized. So, yeah, while the other's not good, and yeah, we wish that were different, and it needs to be different, what just breaks the camel's back here, what again prompts God to punish his people is the state-sponsored garbage that went on in Judah. Again, this is the picture that emerges, again, as you read through Kings and Chronicles and some of these other, you know, basically pretty neglected books. It's just kind of an interesting, again, perspective that, you know, you have such emphasis in different centuries and different places, different, you know, situations, different contexts and whatnot. You know, I'll just give you one more paragraph. He says, state-sponsored cults, and as opposed to private, you know, situations, were more of an issue, as evidenced by references to the Queen of Heaven, the astral gods on rooftops. Again, you have image rooms, you have child sacrifice in the open country that are mentioned by certain prophets. You know, these cults, again, were, you know, the context for them was, you know, are these state-sponsored or is it just somebody kind of doing a crazy thing? And the state-sponsored ones, you know, were the ones that were more issue. He says here, the royally established cult places were the ones extirpated by Josiah. Thus, alongside of official state-sponsored idolatry, there sprouted a widespread individual or family-centered cult, you know, apostate forms of worship, which existed after the destruction of the official Baal cult in North Israel and Judah, and even after Josiah's reform successfully annihilated all the royally sponsored cult places in Judah. They never got rid of everything. But when the kings, like Josiah and Hezekiah, put a stop to the state-sponsored paganism, God said, okay, good job. That's what we need to happen. And then the prophets could sort of preach about, you know, worshiping Yahweh, and you hope that the word circulates. You hope that the priests, you know, are doing their job to you know, sort of forestall or correct what's going on in individual homes. But that isn't the stuff that's going to result in expulsion from the land. What's going to lead to the expulsion from the land is the state-sponsored abominations. So Milgram adds, the biblical evidence of idolatry has yielded thus far the following picture. The difference in the state-endorsed religion of Judah between the 8th and 7th century is largely summarized by a single word, rather by a single person, Manasseh. He reintroduced idolatry into Jerusalem and Judah, completely undoing his father Hezekiah's reform and, of course, Josiah's efforts. Even succeeding the previous status quo, he installed idols in the temple courtyards and in the sanctuary itself, 2 Kings 21 and 23. Also, alongside the official cult, there flourished an ongoing popular cult that continued unabated throughout the 8th and 7th centuries until Judah's destruction. But, again, what triggered the exile for Judah was the reintroduction of officially state-sanctioned apostasy by Manasseh. And this is why Manasseh becomes the focus point in a number of prophetic passages related to the exile. It got cleaned up by Hezekiah and Josiah, but what Manasseh did, again, just that was the trigger point. That was the trigger point. He goes on and talks about the archaeology. You know, it's kind of an interesting observation. He has just one note here. He says archaeological evidence for the popular cult exists and in profusion. Again, just stuff that people were doing in their homes. Among the artifacts, the most likely candidate is the figurine. With respect to idolatry in 8th and 7th century Judah, the entire figurine collection reveals a consistent pattern. So of all the figurines, the archaeologists have found in Judah, here's what you get. The figurines cluster in nonconformist, worship contexts. They are virtually absent from establishment sanctuaries, okay? Whereas a total of 862 figurines, and this article comes from right around the year 2000 or so, 862 figurines were found throughout the countryside of Judah, as opposed to none of them, according to the article, in sort of established Yahwistic, high places. So these figurines that you see pictures of in archaeology, they're typically found in homes. They're typically found in graves. They're typically found in sort of private contexts, private home situations. They're cheap. They're everyday objects. They're crudely fashioned. These Asherah, he talks specifically about Asherah figurines, should not be confused with the cult statue of the biblical Asherah, the ones you read about, the prophets, tearing down and all that stuff at the Bamot. Because those Asherah, again, the official Asherah, were sacred because they were typically made of expensive materials, situated in a public temple, and they represented the goddess in front of the whole population. So again, the whole point is that what's going on in people's houses isn't good, but it's not, again, what's going to be viewed as the reason we're being punished by Yahweh, the reason we are expelled from the land. The reason that happens is because we worshiped rival gods in Yahweh's own presence. We built these bamot, or we used these bamot, right there in the vicinity of the temple. And again, God just isn't going to put up with that. He's not going to share, his worship, with the official priesthood, the official, royal house. He's just not going to share that with anyone else. He's not going to share his sacred space with anyone else or anything else. And that's the thing that triggers, the exile and all that goes with it. Now, in verses 8 to 10, as we wrap up here, I want to say something about the remnant thinking, because I'll read verses 8 through 10 again. Despite all of this, despite all this stuff that's going on, all this stuff that is indicated by the vocabulary, the whole mess, God says, yet I will leave some of you alive. When you have among the nations some who escape the sword, and when you are scattered through the countries, then those of you who escape will remember me among the nations where they are carried captive, how I have broken over, or how I have been broken over their whoring heart that has departed from me and over their eyes that go whoring after their idols. And they will be loathsome in their own sight for the evils that they have committed, for all their abominations. And they shall know that I am the Lord. I have not said in vain that I would do this evil to them." Okay, that's verses 8 through 10. Again, hearkening back, as it were, you know, to his Leviticus 26. Now, again, the basis for the covenant curses come from this older talk in the Torah that your presence in the land is linked to your fidelity to me as a nation, as a monarchy, as kings, as priests. You know, the people are going to make mistakes. They're going to have aberrant worship. But God is actually, again, more tolerant of that sort of thing. He's tolerant of error by ignorance. Again, think back to Leviticus. And he's very intolerant of institutionalized apostasy. And personally, I think that's important because, again, just that little bit of tolerance is going to, again, pave the way for saving a remnant. Again, there's going to be a remnant to just the people who survive, and then there's going to be a remnant of that remnant because some of the people who survive are going to die later on, and pestilence and famine and even in Babylon. But there's going to be some that are saved. There's going to be some that get to return back to Judah. We're going to rebuild the temple. You know, we're going to try it again. God doesn't totally abandon, you know, the whole proposition, even though he could have, because there's so much aberrant worship going on out there. But again, what the focus of the condemnation is knowingly worshiping other gods, knowingly doing what is detestable, knowingly violating Leviticus 26. And again, this the stuff that Deuteronomy, the curses in Deuteronomy, you know, outline. When you have your leadership and just people generally who should know better, when they are doing these things, God is just not going to put up with that. He's going to be a little more tolerant toward people who are just, to quote Jesus, sheep without a shepherd. Yeah, God could punish everybody because none of us are going to be perfect in our worship. None of them were perfect in their worship. They're all going to, you know, do some sort of violation, but they literally have their sheep without a shepherd. It's the ones that bear the greater responsibility to the ones who just, to use the King James language, sin with a high hand. I mean, what they're doing is intentional. It's flaunting their status. It's taking the resources that should go to the proper worship of Yahweh and using them to erect and construct abominable things in Yahweh's own sacred territory, his own city. You know, that is not going to be tolerated. And so, again, do with that what you will. I think there's a lot of ways that we could apply this, again, to our own institutional situation when it comes to, you know, what we think of as the church. That's the kind of thing that will destroy a country, not this or that boneheaded thing that somebody who's truly sincere and just, you know, just kind of messes up or doesn't know better. That's the kind of thing God's going to respond to and say, okay, we need to correct that, send somebody over there, you know, and hopefully they'll be teachable and whatnot. It's just the other side that draws his anger, you know, consistently when there, you just have no excuse. You just have no excuse to be doing this. So, you know, despite all that, I mean, God is plenty angry. I mean, there's plenty of destruction in the exile. Again, we all know how it turned out. We all know the story. And God would have been completely right to just destroy everything and everyone, but he doesn't. He doesn't do it. And we can see in the captives, like in Ezekiel's situation, he's a priest. There will be members of the royal line who are kept alive. There will be, you know, part of the priesthood. There will be people from all stations of life who God spares to, again, learn the lesson and return to him, as Ezekiel says, you know, even in this chapter, you know, I some will survive. I will save some. I will do that. But in terms of the book, the whole explanation, the whole situation is going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. but it's still a good lesson. Again, God, you know, targeting those who should have known better, those who sin with intentionality. And despite even that, despite the degree to which things went bad, you know, God, you know, still finds it within himself to just not call the whole thing off. Again, just not destroy everyone and everything when he would have been perfectly justified in doing so. And so as we proceed through the book of Ezekiel, you're going to get more of this. It's going to be really, really awful stuff. It's going to be graphic in some places. But again, the light's not entirely going to go out. You know, God will ensure that a remnant survives and he doesn't abandon the plan. As I've said many times, there is no plan B. There's only plan A. So as bad as this gets, it's never going to quite, you know, be destroyed.
Mike, real briefly, can you talk about the idolizing of celebrities and stars versus an actual figurine idol and idolatry? I mean, can you touch on that a little bit?
I think because of our culture, we, on the one hand, you know, you could look at that and say, well, it's not really the same thing. It's an abstraction and whatnot. And it is, it's an abstraction. But if you think about what assigning, you know, believing loyalty to Yahweh meant, it's not just an intellectual decision. Okay, you're the God of gods. I got it. Check the box. I passed the quiz. It's more than that. You know, it's a trust in him for your livelihood. It's a trust in him for your preservation, you know, as a family, as a nation, you know, the whole thing. I mean, if you're thinking correctly about Yahweh in an Israelite context, it is more than just passing a quiz. It's life. It's you know, you assign value, you assign worth to Yahweh. Why? Well, because what I have comes from him. Look at what he's done for me. Look at the covenants that he's made. You know, he's our protector. He's our provider. You know, he's the person that we should, again, be devoted to above, you know, all other. We shouldn't be looking at anyone or anything in terms of a value assessment, you know, an affection for, an affinity for, you know, again, just the whole concept, I think, of believing loyalty is a good one. You know, we don't look at any other thing or person to fill these roles for us, to make our life fulfilling, you know, to meet our needs, you know, to, you know, fill in the blank. And I do think, you know, in our culture, you know, we do get distracted in these ways. And again, I actually think more of a problem than particular like celebrities and whatnot, because that, you know, that can border on sort of the absurd in many contexts. But I think of things like government, like job. I mean, the things that really actually put, you know, food on the plate and sort of give us the life that we have. I mean, Kim Kardashian doesn't give anybody the life they have. You know, she just becomes an idol, you know, for some other, you know, absurd reason. But it's these things that, you know, we attribute our own success to certain things, certain acts of our own, certain circumstances of our own that we think we create, or that, you know, we credit to ourselves instead of the Lord. The things that we think will protect us and keep us secure instead of the Lord. To me, that is actually more of an application to idolatry than, again, I love the Cowboys or I love the Eagles and I'm going to watch them on Sunday or whatever, you know, stuff like that. Even though that can become something that displaces something else that ought to be in front of it. But again, I can't help putting myself in the context of an Israelite as to how were you supposed to look at God? How were you supposed to think about him? What were you supposed to understand that you owed to him? You know, why would you be grateful to him? For what are you dependent on? You know, all these sorts of questions, and then ask ourselves, well, are there things besides him that we kind of put in those slots? And to me, that's a bigger issue.
All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate it. And real quick, I'm going to switch gears here. I just want to remind everybody, I've gotten some emails about where they can find the papers that you referenced during the show. And you can get that on our website at nakedbiblepodcast.com. It's actually on the show page. So just click on the episodes page and it'll take you to the actual episode itself where you can get the transcripts of every show. You can get the slides, if there's slides or PDFs or papers that Mike references during the show.
For the most part, I mean, sometimes I can't post something, but
You do a good job. You always tell us which papers you're going to
like the dictionary thing here. I will be sending to Trey because I have that in digital form. I can make a PDF file of that. Journal articles I often can't, but yeah, it's good advice that Trey's giving you. You go up to each page, you know, for the episode, and there's going to be something there, you know, that you can get for. To read, follow along, so on and so forth.
Absolutely. All right, Mike, next week, chapter 7?
Yep, chapter 7 is next week.
All right, well, just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.